Welcome to the Deeper Look podcast for Restoration Church. Each week, we're going to take the passage we're looking at on Sunday and ask questions and go deeper in conversation than we would normally have time to in a gathering. We're asking four big questions. What does this tell us about God? What does this tell us about ourselves? How does this help us love our neighbor? And how can we put this into practice? We're following along the narrative lectionary that's taking us from creation to Pentecost, the full redemptive narrative of Scripture. You can find resources, Bible reading plans at restorationlex.com/restoried. Again, thanks so much for listening. Here we go. All right. Welcome to the Deeper Look podcast for Restoration Church. This is Justin here, and that is Caleb over on the left of my screen, at least. I don't know if it'll show up that way.
Yeah, I'm showing up on the right side of my screen, man. What are you talking about?
Fancy. So we have been, if you are new to this, we have been taking the passages we're looking at on the weekends as we go through the narrative lectionary as part of our Restoried series, and we have been looking at it deeper than we normally could, in a 15, 20-minute message on a Sunday, because if we went into depth on everything in these passages, we would have two-hour-long sermons, and no one wants that. So we are getting together, as we will be continuing to do, with hopefully other voices in the future, too, joining us, but just kind of unpacking these passages and what they mean for us. We ask four big questions. What does this tell us about God? What does this tell us about ourselves? How does this help us love our neighbor? And how can we put this into practice? So those are the four questions. And I will give a disclaimer at the beginning here. Both Caleb and I have children in the home right now. And so if you hear something explode or people yelling right now, I can hear someone with what sounds like a pan flute downstairs going wild. So I don't know. Oh, yeah.
NTI, man. NTI.
NTI. So, all right. So this week's passage, it's kind of a Genesis 37 and then skips and jumps to 50. But we're looking at the story of Joseph. And this takes up a large chunk of Genesis, a big story. It takes, quite a bit of time to go through it. And our reading, at least for the week, deals with a couple different passages there in Genesis 37 and then jumps to kind of the conclusion of the story in Genesis 50. But Caleb, do you have that pulled up and could read that for us? If not, I can certainly do it. But
I don't have it pulled up, man. I can run to it real quick. I don't know the exact verses, but I will read what I know is the gist of the passage and do that real quick. So, Genesis 37, starting in verse 12.
It's 3 through 8 and 17 through 22 and 26 through 34.
So let's do this one at a time. 3 through 8. Now Israel, who's also Jacob, Israel loved Joseph more than any of his other sons because he had been born into his old age, and he made a richly ornamented robe for him. When his brothers saw that their father loved him more than any of them, they hated him and could not speak a kind word to him. Joseph had a dream where he told it to his brothers, and they hated him all the more. He said to them, "Listen to this dream I had. We were binding sheaves of grain out in the field when suddenly my sheaf rose and stood upright, while your sheaves gathered around mine and bowed down to it." His brother said to him, "Do you intend to reign over us? Will you actually rule us?" And they hated him all the more because of this dream and what he had said. What's our next set of verses?
Let's see. That goes from...
That was 3 through 8. That was
3 through 8. Then we have 17 through 22.
All right. They have moved on from here. The man answered, "I heard them say, 'Let's go to Dothan.' So Joseph went after his brothers and found them near Dothan, but they saw him in the distance. And before he reached them, they plotted to kill him. 'Here comes that dreamer,' they said to each other. 'Come now, let's kill him and throw him into one of these cisterns and say that a ferocious animal devoured him. Then we'll see what comes out of his dreams.' When Reuben heard this, he tried not to rescue him from their hands, or he tried to rescue him from their hands. Let's not take his life, he said. Don't shed any blood. Throw him in the cistern here in the desert, but don't lay a hand on him. Reuben said this to rescue him from them and take him back to his father.
All right, then 26 through 34.
26 through 34. Judah said to his brothers, what will we gain if we kill our brother and cover up his blood? Come, let's sell him to the Ishmaelites and not lay our hands on him. After all, he is our brother, our own flesh and blood. The brothers agreed. So when the Midianite merchants came by, his brothers pulled Joseph up out of the cistern and sold him for 20 shekels of silver to the Ishmaelites, who took him to Egypt. When Reuben returned to the cistern and saw that Joseph was not there, he tore his clothes. He went back to his brothers and said, the boy isn't there. Where can I turn now? Then they got Joseph's robe, slaughtered a goat, and dipped the robe into blood. That's like pretty dark. Go kill an animal and selling your brother, right?
Yeah.
They took the ornament and robe back to their father and said, we found this. Examine it to see if it's your son's robe. And Jacob recognized it and said, it is my son's robe. Some ferocious animal has devoured him. Joseph has surely been torn to pieces. Then Jacob tore his clothes, put on sackcloth, and mourned for his son many days. And we skip to chapter 50. We have...
I got that pulled up if you want me to read it.
Yeah, go for it.
All right. So 50, starting in verse 15. When Joseph's brothers saw their father was dead, they said to one another, if Joseph is holding a grudge against us, he will certainly repay us for the suffering we caused him. So they sent this message to Joseph. Before he died, your father gave us a command. Say this to Joseph, please forgive your brother's transgression and their sin, the suffering they caused you. Therefore, please forgive the transgression of the servants of the God of your father. Joseph wept with their message when their message came to him. His brothers also came to him, bowed down before him and said, we are your slaves. But Joseph said to them, don't be afraid. Am I in the place of God? You planned evil against me. God planned it for good to bring about the present result, the survival of many people. Therefore, don't be afraid. I will take care of you and your children. And he comforted them and spoke kindly to them. All right. A lot of scripture there. But let's just summarize this story right here. Joseph is the great-grandson of Abraham that we looked at last week. We have made it down generations now to him. He's one of 13 brothers, the 12th, and obviously from the story is the favorite. And so the older brothers don't like that, and like you said, it gets dark. They throw him into a pit meant to kill him and then end up selling him into slavery and making it look like he got eaten by an animal, broke their father's heart, and Joseph ends up in Egypt.
This could be the plot for a movie. Mm-hmm. Family turning against one another, being sold into trafficking, because that's what this is. It's not just slavery. It's human trafficking in scripture. And then the end, the feel good, not so feel good, is Joseph getting to see his father again and his father learning that his son isn't dead. But like at this point, almost 40 years have passed between Genesis 37 and Genesis 50. And it's like they lost out on 40 years of being able to enjoy what God had given them. Joseph being able to enjoy his father's love and Jacob being able to enjoy his son. I mean, it's just
a
tragic story with a happy but not happy, bittersweet ending.
Yeah. It's phenomenal to me that Genesis spends 38 chapters on four generations of one family and that you get, ultimately it is a family story. It is dysfunctional beyond belief. I mean, there's stuff that we don't even get into between, 37 and 50 that's super dark. The Bible does not shy away from some very difficult situations. And these are not those people out there. These are God's people. These are the people of the covenant who are making horrendous choices and in many ways, betraying the covenant that God, made with them. And yet the story shows that he continues to be faithful to the people who continue to turn away from him over and over and over again.
So. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you've got everything from incest to murder to just what I've heard someone call it rabble rousing. I mean, like just stirring up trouble from some of these other brothers. And Jacob, Israel, actually calls them out at the end of his life. It's like, you two are murderers. You are too rough on people. You go around killing animals just for the heck of it, or torturing animals, messing with animals just for the heck of it. I mean, like, it's just one of those, oh my gosh, like, this is about as real gets.
Yeah.
And funny enough, like, one of the interesting parts of the story is Jacob doesn't even bless Joseph's sons the way that Joseph wants them to be blessed, because of their birthright, birth order, and some patriarchal things. But it's like, I don't know. This story is just so, so, so deep, filled with so much emotion.
Yeah.
That it's hard to do a 30-minute or even a 45-minute podcast.
Yeah. It's interesting to me because, you know, he's the kind of go into what happens. I mean, he gets, goes to, sold to captain of the army in Egypt, and his wife Potiphar makes a move on him. He denies it. She lies, sends him to prison. He ends up interacting with a few of the servants of the Pharaoh who he interprets the dream. But they leave him in there. 2 years later, the Pharaoh has a dream. It's kind of about famines. Nobody can interpret it. And so they remember, hey, Joseph can do this. So Joseph comes, interprets the dreams, gives him a plan, and then Pharaoh makes him basically the prime minister, second in command over all of Egypt. And what's interesting in this is that in all the, I found within all the story that you read, with everything that's happening to Joseph, you, at least if I'm, maybe I'm missing something, but there's no emotion we see from him until he meets his brothers. Like he's not, you don't see him complaining in prison. You don't see him, you know, lamenting the fact that that his circumstances are unjust. In fact, as soon as he's thrown in prison, it immediately says like he gets favor, you know, with the prison guard and begins to use his leadership skills there. You don't see emotion until the brothers. I think that's significant. That's really significant that out of all the suffering he faces, it's still the pain of his broken relationships with family that is the hardest hurt he faces.
Yeah, that's what gets him. I mean, if you run through some of the emotions just on the few passages that we read, you've got a father who loses a son, which is the one thing, the worst thing a parent could ever face is losing their child to death. Like their child just being gone. Like no parent should ever have to face that. I've seen it a few times in my life where parents have lost their children, and it is just the most excruciating, gut-wrenching, not even words for it sort of thing. Like just the damage that it does. So you've got that in this story. Then, of course, you've got the brothers who are just doing this cover-up, who know they've done wrong, and basically have to live with this dark secret the rest of their lives, hiding it from their dad. And it's like, you've got that human emotion side of thing. You've got Joseph, who, again, he's just taken away from everything. He doesn't even get to experience the love of a family, and he doesn't seem to complain about it, which is pretty wild.
Yeah.
But you know it's there because he does get emotional when he sees his brothers again, and he does throw himself on his father when his father dies, and he just begins weeping almost and like uncontrollably, according to the passage. And I don't know, the emotion side of it, like you would think Joseph would just be filled with uncontrollable rage.
Yeah.
I think if this were me, and I'd been trafficked, and my family had turned against me, and I had all these things ripped against me, I would be mad. I'd be really angry. And if I'm real honest, it would be hard not to seek retaliation for what people had done.
Yeah.
To me, or what had happened to those that I love, like the father in this story suffering, oh, my child's dead. Like Joseph knew that. I'm sure he knew that, even though he wasn't there firsthand for it. They had to cover it up somehow. And yeah, it's just tragic.
Yeah. Yeah. I was talking about it this weekend with the message, but this is how every villain origin story starts. Like in their youth, something incredibly tragic and or unjust happens to them. And then they spend the rest of their lives like trying to use power to fill that hole of pain or to retaliate or whatnot. And this very easily could have been one of those stories where Joseph internalizes everything that happens to him and then he has the power to actually really retaliate in ways that no one could in that ancient time at all. And yet he doesn't. And that's significant too. I mean, obviously when you have wounded people in power, bad things can happen. I think we see that pretty clearly, but this power that he had did not become a source of trying to get back at the things that had hurt him. And I think what you see in what the passage really shows is that it is God that's doing that. It's God that has given him confidence in what, you know, in him leading through Joseph's life, that he's actually sovereign over the things that are happening within his life. So pretty significant.
Yeah, and Joseph even acknowledges that. He essentially says it's God's place to judge. It's not mine. And I think Joseph had come to this, I don't know how exactly, but Joseph had come to this understanding of a God who really desires mercy over sacrifice.
Yeah.
He got that in this passage. He understands this. I think that's why he responds to his brothers the way that he responds to them. And it wasn't just like his response wasn't just, I'm going to forgive you and move on with my life and you move on with yours. You know, it was like, it was just this, I'm going to forgive you. I'm going to show mercy to you. I'm going to take care of you and your children. And I'm also going to take care of you and your children's children. And it's just like this radical mercy and grace and a testament to what he tells his brothers. What you meant for harm, God meant for good, or God used for good, not God meant for good, God used for good. And I think that's one of those distinctions we probably need to talk about in this story real quick. Often we say that, it was God's plan for bad things to happen to you so that something good could happen to you. Like, no, that's not the way God works. God doesn't cause bad things to happen to you. That's not God's plan for you. Sometimes bad things happen and God can use those bad for God. It's called resurrection. It's God breathing life into dead situations because that's who God is.
Mm-hmm.
So that just a little aside.
That's massively important because I think people interpret God's sovereignty as this very stoic determinism that is, you know, everything is already, you know, already planned out. And so God planned for you to suffer. And there are, you know, kind of, you know, some streams of hyper-Calvinism that, you know, believe that God plans for you to suffer so that you can do this. But the sovereignty of God, I think what we see there and in Romans 8:28 is not that God plans for you to have these moments and these experiences of suffering, but even through these experiences and suffering, he has the power to weave everything together for our good. And so it's taking the impetus of like God's desire to cause you to suffer and saying God weeps with you. Obviously, we see in Jesus, he weeps with us in suffering, and he uses absolutely everything, both good and bad, to weave together for our good, for his glory, for his purposes. And that's a big difference, because if you suffer and you just internalize this as, well, this was God's plan for me, you know, because I'm a means to an end, basically, for God, then you get a very distorted understanding of his character.
Mm-hmm.
That's definitely not what I don't think the passage is saying. I know it's been interpreted that way before.
Right.
I certainly think that.
Which leads us into our first question. What does this passage say about who God is? What do you think, man?
Well, I mean, what's interesting about this story in particular, and again, there's a lot of verses, a lot of chapters. So if I'm missing something, let me know. But we never see Joseph praying. Like there's not really much of a like with Abraham and God talking, and there's some of that with Jacob too. But there just seems to be God involved in every intricate detail, but not necessarily Joseph, you know, crying out or interacting or arguing with him like Abraham did. But you kind of see that even when we are unaware of his work in our lives, that God is always present and at work, which is a foundational thing for us at Restoration. And I say it over and over and over again, that there's not a circumstance where God is not present and not at work in our lives. Because even if we experience suffering, or we even experience suffering at our own hands, God is still present in it, and he still is working these things for good. And so to know that about the character of God, it could not be more important, because it's sometimes concluded that if I mess up, then God's going to go away, that God doesn't want to be around me. That the language we used, I remember growing up, was God in his holiness cannot be near sin. And there's a sense that, yeah, that's true. But then you see Jesus, who is not just near sin, he's touching the sinners. He is eating with them. And so you understand that the nearness of God is not complicated by our poor choices. He is still working things together for our good. And thank God for that. So,
yeah,
that's what I'd say, Lise. How about you?
Yeah, I would say something similar. I think the thing that it reveals to me, at least, is if we're created in the image of God, and that's a part of our identity or our identity, you've got Joseph reflecting the image of God in the world when he interacts with his brothers. I go back to the mercy versus sacrifice thing, and Joseph shows them mercy. And doesn't demand sacrifice, doesn't demand some kind of extravagant gift from them to make them, to forgive them. Mm-hmm. I think that's the thing about forgiveness too, is sometimes, like, when we think about forgiveness, we're thinking, well, you have to do something to be forgiven. Mm-hmm. And that's not the way that forgiveness works. Forgiveness comes from the forgiver. Yeah. They extend it regardless of what the other person Absolutely. Does. And Joseph's displaying that here. And I think that points to who God is as well. As we see throughout the rest of Scripture, we have a God who forgives regardless of what we're doing, or a God who's slow to become angry regardless of what we're doing. Or we have Jesus who dies on the cross, knowing some people still are going to say no to him, and he's still offering forgiveness. So I think this is just one story in the grander story of people who understand this about God and live it out.
Yeah. That's good. It's really good. Yeah. There's a lot to unpack there with this and what it means for the rest of the story too.
Yeah.
What would you say? What do you think this reveals about ourselves as image bearers, as human beings, as those created by God?
I think we're probably capable of anything, good or bad, is what this story tells. You've got everything from murder to radical forgiveness. And it's not like some people are predestined to be murderers, or some people are predestined to be radical forgivers. I don't think that's how it works.
Yeah.
And I think maybe the difference is, How in tune are we willing to be with God? Like, yeah. How willing are we to submit to God? Like Jesus, and I think it's Luke chapter 6 or 7, says, love your enemies, bless those who curse you, pray for those who persecute you. Like, am I really willing to turn that over to God and accept that and try to live that?
Yeah.
And I mean, you have that in this particular story. Joseph knew that his place wasn't as judge over his brothers. It's God's place. So yeah, as far as we go, we could end up on either side, either extreme of this, and it really comes down to, am I willing to submit to the way of God?
Yeah. Yeah, I think about that in terms of, you know, Abraham having this radical encounter with God, and then Isaac comes about. There's not a whole lot about Isaac, but then you get Jacob. And Jacob's, obviously, there's a lot of messiness there. But he has his own, like, very real encounter with the living God. But then as kids, you see choices that are just utterly against everything that the God that his, you know, his fathers have worshiped. Like, that perhaps we can assume sometimes that our cultural or familial connections mean that we are not those who carry the same brokenness, that you can't look at this story and say that, well, there's God's holy people and then there's the broken, sinful world out there. Like, you see the utter depravity of human yes. choice in this story, and it's in here. And as people of faith, that should be humbling to know that, you know, the same, we can make, like you said, we can make the same choices. And at the beginning of Genesis, we see, you know, in Genesis 3, we see Adam and Eve choosing to make themselves the center of the story. And then in Genesis 50, very last chapter, what I love about that Joseph's statement, he says, am I in the place of God? As if to say, I'm not going to put myself in the place of God. And so there's a turn there of, you know, the broken choice of making yourself the center of the story. And what redeems the story, what redeems the lives of thousands of people, is someone who chooses to not make themselves the center of the story, but sees God as the author and perfecter of their faith. And that transforms every circumstance. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, as people trying to follow Jesus, I think not only knowing the sovereignty of God in that, but also knowing that our choices matter. And like you said, walking with God and choosing to make him the center of our story instead of the other way around changes, not only impacts our lives, but impacts the lives of other people, for better or for worse, which is comforting and also scary at the same time.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
So how do we live this out?
How does this help us love our neighbor? Just skip one?
Yeah, that one. Sorry.
No, I think to point out something I forgot to say, maybe with God too, is that, you know, this saves Joseph's choice and what happens when he's saying, hey, listen, God chose to do this or use this so that many people will be saved. Many Egyptians were saved. And so the promise of Abraham in Genesis 12 that you'll be a blessing to all nations is again shown in this, because people that are, you know, end up being the enemies of God's people, God preserves their life. He preserves their life through the choices of his covenant family. And so, again, that's baked into the story once again, that our faith is not just for our faith. It's for the sake of others, for the sake of those who are not like us, who don't vote like us, who don't think like us and look like us. And so
yeah, it
helps us love our neighbor, and that we understand that our faith is not an inward facing faith. It is pointing us outward to be a blessing to others. It hopefully changes our posture and how we understand our place in the world.
Yeah. Man, I'm going to go back to the classic love your enemies thing, because enemies are neighbors. Jesus makes that clear, the parable of the Good Samaritan. I look at this story and I think about the kind of enemies Joseph was wrestling with. I mean, this his enemies were his own flesh and blood, his own brothers. And they're the worst kind of enemy, because these are supposed to be the people who love you no matter what. The people that you're supposed to be able to rely on no matter what happens in life. and they chucked them to the side. And they didn't just chuck them to the side. They sold them off into slavery.
One of the commentators points out that the next thing is that they start eating a meal. Like, it's, they're so cold to the life of their own brother that they're just like, oh, let's have lunch now after we just
despise them. Yeah. I mean, just in the pain that comes from that, the bitterness that comes from that sort of thing, and anger, just the wrath that kind of builds up inside of you sort of thing. And I go to the end of the story of him, I not only forgive you, but I'm going to take care of you and your children and your children's children. I mean, like, that's when Jesus says, love your enemies. Like, that's the perfect image of loving your enemies. It's not just putting up with them. It's being there for them. It's giving them life, choosing to exist in such a way that you give even your enemies life.
Yeah.
So as far as loving my neighbor, I've got enemies I know. I've got enemies I don't know. I've got social media enemies. I've got political enemies. I mean, there are people that I'm incredibly disappointed in that I don't necessarily know personally, but who represent me as an American citizen, for example. And there's a lot of that going on this week and in previous weeks, and it's like, I don't know how to love you, but I'm going to try to figure it out because I do believe that's what Jesus wants out of me.
Yeah.
Because I do believe that that's what brings life.
Yeah.
And that's hard. I'm not going to pretend like it's easy or that it's romantic or it's like something we want to chase after, but I do think that's just the way God works in the world. So trying to figure that out this week.
That's a good point. I think, and you know, if you listen to this weeks later, sorry, but you know, what's happening in our world right now is the Breonna Taylor verdict and the outrage and stuff that's happening. I think it helps us love our neighbor in that I think if we come to this situation from a very detached, don't worry, God is in control sort of thing, as if God ordained injustice or ordained, you know, violence or things like that. But we can, as followers of Jesus, step into the situation both with lament, because we know that suffering is often unjust and always a tragedy. But then also we can offer the hope that in spite of this, God did not cause this, but God is weaving these things for good. So we need both that lament and hope in our relationships with our neighbors, and not just a sort of a bland optimism or something like that, or positivity, positive vibes. We need both the love that is expressed in lamenting with our brothers and sisters, and also the hope of knowing what's being built together. So,
yeah. And you see that, you see both those things in this passage. And the hard truth is, love's not always going to feel good. Right. So sometimes love is a choice. Probably 99% of the time, love is a choice. Yeah, good stuff, man.
Yeah. How do we put this into practice?
Oh, gosh. I don't know. Is it as simple as taking a cue from Joseph? Is there anyone that we need to extend forgiveness to this week, whether they're asking for it or not, whether we think they deserve it or not? Forgiveness doesn't mean, just as an aside, forgiveness doesn't mean letting yourself get hurt or get in a bad situation. It doesn't mean that you go and necessarily like trying to make things back to normal with someone if they've caused you long-term hurt or something like that. But it does mean not letting that person poison you because you're bitter. So that might be someone's forgiveness situation, or it might be, I just need to go have a talk with my family. We've had issues, and we need to forgive one another and hash this out. So yeah, I mean, not getting too in depth. Forgiveness is the practical way to live out the story this week.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, I totally agree. And I think the family piece has really stuck with me, because I think there's going to be folks, well, I know there's going to be folks that listen to this and read this that have a ton of brokenness in their family. And that Pete Scazzaro in his book, Unhealthy Spirituality, or Emotionally Healthy Spirituality, I almost got that really wrong. He said that, you know, Jesus may be in your heart, but grandpa's in your bones. And it means that we have to reckon with our own stories, our own past, and how our family has impacted us, because a lot of times we're inflicting on others the wounds that we've experienced in the past or are currently experiencing. And so it's the same thing with our families, both lament and hope, that, you know, Joseph, in a sense, broke the cycle of a lot of negative choices in his family by forgiveness. It broke the cycle of another generation of bad choices. And I'm sure there were more after that.
That is a word. That's a good word.
Yeah. And that, and so there's, I mean, I can think of situations in my own family that are broken seemingly beyond repair. And what forgiveness would look like in that situation. And so having the courage as followers of Jesus to know, A, we belong to a family that is not going to hurt us, or, well, they'll hurt us, but belong to a family that is that we always belong to, Jesus, you know, says we belong to because of that. Even when we, our earthly families say we don't belong, we do belong. And we have something to hold on to in that. So, yeah. Amen. So much. This is freaking 20 something chapters, man. There's just so much you could deal with here, but I encourage you guys, if you're watching this, to read Genesis 37 through 50, sit down, and won't take you that long to read, maybe 30 minutes, and just get the full roller coaster of the story that it is, and listen to the Spirit speak to you in this. And this is obviously not live, but if we're going to post this on podcasts and social media too. So if you end up having questions or comments, go ahead and put that in the comment section. We'll be paying attention. Yep. You can also email us at justin@restorationlex, or you can send to caleb@storied.org, Caleb with a K. And we'd love to interact with you, hear your thoughts, questions, and whatnot. As we continue through the story. Next week, we move out of Genesis into Exodus and the Passover, another massively important story for God's big narrative of redemption. So, Caleb, appreciate it.
Yeah.
We'll see you back in this space on Sunday, and then we'll be back for a deeper look next week. Cool.
Sounds great. Yep. Love you guys. Peace.
See you.